All right, our next case is number 212277, ABC Corporation versus Partnership and Unincorporated Associations. Before we begin, both counsel should be aware that the court is very displeased that you did not comply with the court's rules so this argument could take place in person. It's extremely awkward to do it by video. And you should have known better, and you signed declarations stating your awareness of the court's protocols, and yet you created a situation where we have to have a remote argument where we should have had it in person. With that said, Mr. Cheng, why don't you start?
Thank you, Your Honor, and I apologize for not complying with the testing. May it please the court, my name is Hugh Chin, and I represent the 8 defendants in this consolidated appeal. This consolidated appeal includes several procedure and substantive issues. The first issue is whether or not the district court abused its discretion denying defendants' motion to vacate the preliminary injunction that was entered in November 2020. The district court granted an ex parte preliminary injunction request from the plaintiffs. Plaintiffs in this case asked for an ex parte preliminary injunction. Plaintiffs filed motions to seal the complaint and the schedules of defendants in order to prevent defendants from learning about this case and from learning about the pending motion of the preliminary injunction against them. This is a very definition of an ex parte request for an order without waiting a response from the other side. And under the rule of the Seventh Circuit, an ex parte preliminary injunction is manifestly error because Rule 65A forbids preliminary injunction order to be granted without a notice to the adverse party. And there's no authority supporting plaintiff's view that a late notice in the proceedings can cure the procedural defects of this ex parte preliminary injunction.
Mr. Chen,
yes, Your Honor.
This argument, I understand, applies to the 2020 preliminary injunction, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it doesn't apply to the 2021 preliminary injunction.
It does not, however. There's no separation between the 2020 preliminary injunction and the 2021 preliminary injunction. If the 2020 preliminary injunction was declared as invalid and was vacated by the district court, then we agree there's no procedure defects in the 2021 preliminary injunction. However, the two preliminary injunctions overlap with each other, and the 2021 preliminary injunction, the ex parte nature in the 2020 preliminary injunction permeated into the 2021 preliminary injunction, since there's no separation. And
I'm sorry, I don't understand what that means.
Means that without a separation, there is no separation between the two preliminary injunctions.
So are you suggesting that because there was a notice problem with respect to the 2020 preliminary injunction, we should also think that the 2021 preliminary injunction is invalid, even though there was notice for that? It sounds like that's what you're arguing. Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor, because the 2021, first is the 2021 preliminary injunction motion was ordered by the district court basically to cure the defects in the 2020 preliminary injunction.
Okay, yeah, he made independent findings supporting the 2021 preliminary injunction, including probability of success on the merits, and you argue that finding wasn't supported by the record. So you have independent grounds for challenging the 2021 injunction, which have nothing to do with the procedural defects in the 2020 injunction, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, but only if the 2021 preliminary injunction was recognized as invalid and vacated by the district court. Without vacating the first ex parte preliminary injunction, there's no separation between those two orders. And to this date, the 2020 preliminary injunction is still valid. How can we distinguish whether or not a defendant was restrained because of the 2020 preliminary injunction.
We understand your notice argument on the 2020 preliminary injunction. We appreciate that. Do you want to talk about your separate argument with respect to the 2021 preliminary injunction, or even both, with respect to whether there were particularized enough findings by the district court judge to support that preliminary issuance of the preliminary injunction? Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor, and that comes to the second point, is whether or not the district court abused its discretion in finding that plaintiff has met the burden of proving a likelihood of winning on the merits. The Seventh Circuit recognized that a lack of explanation often constitutes an abuse of discretion, especially when the decision left unexplained is not apparent from the record. Therefore, the district, no matter how concise that is, has to justify its decision, and not just providing a mere conclusion. And especially when the reason is not apparent from the record. And in this present case, the only reasoning provided by the district court is that because both parties provided expert witness reports, and to resolve the expert disputes require a trial. And the need for trial is sufficient to demonstrate that plaintiff have met its burden to prove a likelihood of winning on the merit. And we think this is conclusory and not supported by any legal or factual findings.
Can you enumerate what specific issues the district court you think was required to address? So far you said what the district court did is not enough. To know whether it's not enough, I'm interested in hearing what do you think needed to be there to get into the realm of the enough?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, a likelihood of winning on the merit require a movement to show that it's more likely to win on the merit than they're not winning on the merit. So the need for trial only proves
no,
the issue.
I think you're just going over right. old ground. I'm interested in your saying for a design patent, one has to look at the specifics of the design and compare each of the four things to each of the accused products. Something that's the kind of thing I'm looking for you to explain your view on.
Yes, Your Honor. So when challenging a design patent or a design patent, defendants raised several substantial questions of infringement. And one of them is that the plaintiff applied the wrong ordinary observer standard. And quoting from their expert witness report, plaintiff in this case argues that an ordinary observer is a typical purchaser of hoverboards. Consumers or their parents each have little or no experience, and their only knowledge is from social media exposure, from TV commercials, and from retail stores.
Is the argument here that the ordinary observer has to be familiar with the prior art, and that there's no discussion of the looking at through the lens of the prior art in the district court's decision?
Yes, Your Honor. So having little to no experience does not signify the familiarity with prior arts. The standard purported articulated in the Egyptian goddess case requires that the hypothetical ordinary observer to be conversant with all the prior arts. And explain in that case, the ordinary observer is deemed to view the difference between the patent design and the accused design in the context of prior art. And the difference between the claimed and the accused designs are viewed in light of prior arts, then the attention of this hypothetical ordinary observer will be drawn to those aspects of the claimed design that differs from the prior arts. And when the claimed design is close to the prior arts, then the small differences between the accused design and the claimed design are likely to be important to this hypothetical ordinary observer. So those small differences may indeed become substantially dissimilar to prove that the accused products does not infringe on the accused patent, asserted patent. And, in your honor, and that comes to my third point, is that the district court abused its discretion in finding, abused its discretion in issuing an order which violates Rule 65D.
Can I just return to the meritsy subject for a second? Do you also think that the district court was required to explain the likelihood of success from the proper perspective, namely a person who knows at least something about the prior art, to make that explanation patent by patent and accused product by accused product?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, can you repeat the question, please?
Do you also think that the district court's opinion was deficient in not making the comparison patent by patent and accused product by accused product to determine whether those design differences would were problematic or likely problematic or not likely problematic?
Well, Your Honor, that would be the ideal situation, that a full explanation is provided by the district court. We do not think a full analysis is required, but at least the conclusion is there need to be some factual finding or legal analysis.
Why isn't a full analysis required on a product-by-product basis and patent-by-patent basis?
Why is it not required?
Why is it not required? I mean, at least there should be at least one patent that there's a likelihood that every product infringes at least one patent, right?
Yes. Well, from defendant's perspective, a comparison would certainly help to determine or help defendants to understand whether or not
how can you enjoin a product unless there's a specific finding with respect to that product that there's a likelihood of success?
Exactly, Your Honor. That's our point. This decision is so conclusory. It's not supported by any factual findings or any comparison of the accused products to the prior arts, to the accused, to the asserted patents. There's so little factual findings supporting the decision, which make it an abuse of discretion from the district court perspective.
Can I ask you? This is, I guess, more back to some of the earlier discussion about the relation of the 2021 preliminary injunction and the 2020. Did the district court's 2021 preliminary injunction supersede and displace the 2020 preliminary injunction, or are both somehow still in effect?
We think they're both in effect. Because they do have different scopes. The 2021 preliminary injunction included additional third parties who were not served with process or who received no notice. So the scope of the 2020 preliminary injunction and 2021 preliminary injunction, even though they overlap with each other, the scope of the two preliminary injunctions are different.
I'm sorry, but I didn't quite understand it. So first, I guess I have a technical question. Did the 2021 supersede the 2020?
Not according to the district court's order.
And is there a way in which the 2020 preliminary injunction is broader than the 2021 one? Or is the difference in scope only the other way, that the 2021 preliminary injunction covers everything in the 2020 but more? Or is there's obviously a third possibility, right?
The 2020 preliminary injunction had additional parties that was later dismissed from this case. So At the currently, the 2021 preliminary injunction, the scope of 2021 preliminary injunction covers the scope of 2020 preliminary injunction.
What about Gynor U.S.? There's a contention by the appellees here that the 2021 injunction doesn't cover Gynor U.S.
The general U.S. was not mentioned in the general U.S. Your Honor, I see my time's coming up. Can I finish answering the question? The 2021 preliminary injunction motion was filed against seven defendants, and after briefing and after court hearing, the order was granted to the motion.
Does it cover Gynor U.S.? The 2021 injunction.
The motion was not filed to include Gynor U.S. However, a later filed proposed order significantly expanded the scope of the order that was filed with the court. Of the motion that was filed with the court. So when the court initially decided to grant the preliminary injunction motion, that was, according to the hearing at least, was granted against seven defendants that were included in the preliminary injunction motion. But then a proposed order then that was adopted by the district court includes 17 additional third parties or defendants in this case.
Including Gynor U.S.?
Yes, including Jerry U.S. So Jerry U.S. was not initially included in the motion when the motion was decided, but the final order issued by the district court also includes Jerry U.S. As one of the defendants in the exhibit.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chen. We'll give you two minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Berkowitz?
Good morning. This is Mark Berkowitz for the plaintiffs at FLEs. And again, apologies for the late switch to remote. May it please the court. As we sit here today,
so there's no question, right, that the district court did not comply with Rule 65 in entering the 2020 preliminary injunction, correct?
Yes. Okay. I think that, as we sit here today, all the defendants are bound by the 2021 preliminary injunction, and it does, in effect, supersede the 2020 preliminary injunction. It is only broader. It includes additional defendants.
Okay, so do you agree that the 2020 injunction should be vacated?
No, I think that there's really not, well, two responses. There's really no reason to vacate it at this point. The 2021 injunction is controlling, and I think in this particular case,
you can't keep an injunction just because there's a duplicative second injunction entered. Why shouldn't we order the 2020 injunction to be vacated? And then focus on the question of whether the 2021 injunction was properly entered.
I think the reason that it shouldn't be vacated is because of the history here. I think that on its face, certain defendants weren't notified at that, at the particular time, but they did appear a short time later. They did participate for approximately 7 months.
Rule 65 says they have to have notice at the time of the injunction, right? And you agree that that's been violated, right?
Yes, but I think that it could also be waived. The defendants here did appear, late December, January, late December of 2020.
What legal support do you have for the idea that notice isn't really required under Rule 65 because it can be waived? Because so long as they get notice sometime in the next year or so, it's okay.
Well, I think that it's really a factual issue that the defendants here did appear. They did contest many other issues that they charged. They filed motions to dismiss, motions for summary judgment, and there were many challenges to the PI. And this issue of the notice came up much later in a context of a reply on a motion to vacate, which the defendants actually appealed that motion and then ended up dismissing the motion later on. So I think that history has to constitute waiver. both because
Can you explain, this is I think another version of the question we've been talking about. Can you explain what is your concrete stake in not having the November 2020 preliminary injunction vacated?
I think that as a practical matter, the concern would be that any funds that have been frozen would be released. I don't think I would hope that that wouldn't happen because of the 2021 preliminary injunction. That, as I said, I believe, you know, addresses this issue and does bind all of the defendants.
So does the 2021 injunction freeze the assets the same way the 2020 did?
It should, yes. It has the same language. It provides the same directives to these same third parties to go ahead and freeze those funds.
Your concern, I guess, is that the funds that had been frozen under the 2020 preliminary injunction, there might be some time frame in which before the 2021 preliminary injunction was issued.
Yeah, I think that the concern would be that vacating that initial preliminary injunction would sort of act to unfreeze those funds. I don't think that would our hope is that would not happen, because that has always been the issue here for the district court, and that, you know, that these particular defendants wouldn't, you know, if the injunction were to be lifted, that they would immediately deplete the funds and they would become judgment proof. So there's always been that concern, you know, and we've seen that. We've seen a situation where the funds have been depleted and the defendants were indeed sanctioned for doing that. So our preference would be to keep, you know, to keep the 2020 injunction in place. And we do believe that by participating in the action for so long and filing so many motions.
Okay, but the motions to vacate argued that the injunction, 2020 injunction, should be vacated because of the Rule 65 violation. And the district court seemed not to rule on that, but to say it doesn't matter because of the 2021 injunction. That can't be right.
Well, I think at some point, both the plaintiffs and the court said the right way to go forward is to hold the second PI and just to alleviate, you know, any potential issues. And the injunction was maintained in the interim. And
that because the 2021 injunction proceeding was procedurally proper, that somehow argues for keeping in place the 2020 injunction, which was procedurally improper.
Right. If our position is that the 2021 injunction fully supersedes the earlier one. It covers the same.
So under that theory, then we should vacate the earlier injunction, right?
We don't think it's necessary, but we think that as a practical matter, it wouldn't change the outcome, change where we sit right now, which is all the defendants are enjoying.
Okay, could we address the 2021 injunction, where it appears that the district court hardly made any findings at all, certainly didn't mention the prior art, which showed the hourglass shape, nor did he analyze the individual products to determine whether there was a likelihood of success with respect to those products. And some of those products seem to be quite different, particularly product D from the patented product. How could you possibly enter a preliminary injunction here without engaging in the required analysis?
Sure. So there was here too just quite a bit of history. You know, the court did refer back to his prior rulings, and there, you know, the court did, you know, we looked at the expert declarations that were submitted, and in this case, the plaintiff's motion was
the court supported. Basically didn't say anything, right, to justify the injunction, other than a conclusory statement that it was a probability of success.
Well, he also says that an ordinary observer would be deceived to thinking that the products sold by the Gyroware defendants are the same as the products manufactured and sold by plaintiffs that utilize.
Why isn't that very conclusory? That's just a conclusion. That's not a finding.
He does, if you look at the order, he does, you know, sort of, he does include, you know, each of the patents, he includes all the photographs, and then it's followed by this finding.
It doesn't have any written comparison, no discussion of the prior art, no discussion comparing different design patents to different products, none of that, right?
No, that is not there. What was included in the PI was the declaration of Paul Hatch, which did go through that analysis, and it did explain, you know, why each of the patents covered different products that were accused.
Are you familiar with our decision in the International Rectifier?
I'm not.
That's a case where we held that a injunction, whether it's a preliminary or permanent injunction, has to have language that would prohibit the sale of particular products, or it would be, you know, make you sell particular devices, those being found to have likely to infringe, and devices that are no more than colorably different from that.
Right. So in this case,
the injunction says something different, right?
The injunction, I think that the key of the injunction is also the schedules themselves, which identify specific products, by their particular listings on the relevant marketplaces.
But doesn't the injunction prohibit infringement of the design patents? It doesn't prohibit making certain products or products that are no more colorably different than those products, right?
Well, I think it's the way it's drafted. It's limited to those particular products that are identified specifically, plus those that are colorably different. You know, what is colorably different is a factual question that was addressed later in the proceedings in the context of the sanctions motions. So just to address the arguments that the appellant raised in their brief as far as the merits, there was really three things that they raised. And one was this due weight argument that they claim must be given to later filed patents. I think that argument was not fully teed up below. The argument that was actually made below was more of a practicing the prior art defense, what defendants and their experts we're saying.
Can I interrupt you for a moment? I'm sorry. I'm going back to the answer you just gave me. You said that the injunction refers to the appendix in order to identify the products that cannot be sold. But wouldn't that violate Rule 65D? You can't incorporate by reference the acts or after acts restrained or required.
Well, they're not incorporated by reference. In the 2021 preliminary injunction, they're included there as part of the order. The reason that they weren't included in the 2020 preliminary injunction was because those were confidential appendices, and it's pretty common in the District of Illinois and many other courts to include confidential appendices by reference.
In an order,
the 2021
should include the 2020 court, which is confidential.
Sorry, I didn't catch
you. You can't have a court order which is confidential. It has to be on the record to give notice to the parties and anybody who deals with them.
My understanding, you know, is that the schedules of defendants and products are often kept confidential, and notice is given to the specific defendants as it comes up.
What case says you can have a court order that enjoins things that are confidential?
There is actually, sorry, I can't put my finger on it. There's a recent case from this court that acknowledges that at least the Ninth Circuit routinely does incorporate confidential appendices in preliminary injunction motions. And I could submit that my letter after.
I just want to go back to my question, too, about International Rectifier. I just want to make sure I understand your answer. This injunction says that it prohibits offering for sale, selling, importing any reproduction copy or colorable imitation of the design claimed in the patents in suit. It doesn't refer to the products that are found likely to infringe. And that seems to violate our precedent in international rectifier. Do you agree?
No, I think that if you look at the first page, it's Appendix 15, it does refer to Exhibit A of the...
you say Appendix 15?
Wait, is that,
yes.
Is that the 20?
That's a preliminary injunction order.
But I, if you look at what is expressly prohibited on page A24... I'm not sure what you're referring me to on page A15.
Sure. So the order refers to the appendices of exhibits A through C at appendix 26. It's under paragraph 4C. It requires certain listings to be disabled, and those are understood to be the particular joint product.
Okay.
All right, anything further?
Just... Same thing, just to quickly address the attacks on the this ordinary observer that our expert Mr. Hatch used. They're confusing the definition of ordinary observer with his actual analysis of the prior art. There's nothing in his ordinary observer that would exclude analysis of prior art. You can see from his analysis that he did actually use the prior art for each patent in reaching the conclusion. And I would note that just much of that is brief is sort of general challenges to infringement. I think roughly half of the brief is just sort of re-arguing the issues without really providing any citation to the record below in support. So that's all I'd like to say. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Cheng, I think you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just have 2 points in my rebuttal. The first is that plaintiff made it very clear that they prefer to have the ex parte preliminary injunction stay in place while file another preliminary injunction motion that covers the scope of the first preliminary injunction. And that is what was granted by the district court. The district court ordered the first ex parte preliminary injunction to stay in place while ordered plaintiff to file a second preliminary injunction, basically to cure the procedure defects in the first one. And that effectively bypasses Rule 65A notice requirement. And allowing this practice will send out message to potentially encourage procedure abuse. And the second question, the second point is we do agree with Your Honors that without a comparison, product by product, patent by patent, it's far to argue that the products accused here infringe on the accused patent because the lack of analysis essentially renders the decision unreviewable because there's just such a lack of sufficient facts in the legal analysis in the district order. And that's my point. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank both counsel. The case is submitted. Our